Can we get started, please? Today, this is a informal meeting of the House Resources Committee and is being attended by other interested persons, Representative Bernard, Davis, Sund, and Cotton. And Mr. Eason is here to tell us about Sale 55. And at this point, I would just say, why don't you go ahead, unless other members of the legislature had immediate questions. Why don't you give us your presentation on it, and then we'll open it up to questions from anybody in the room.
Good. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you. And when I spoke with Ned last week, he indicated that your primary interest was to talk about Sale 55, and so we can focus as much time as we want on that. But I also got along with some handouts, which are being handed out now for those of you who don't have them, that were handed out last week. And these materials are titled Topics of Oil and Gas Topics of Interest, and they are a collection of things that I thought might be of interest to one or more of you that we have been involved in recently, and most of these things are continuing involvement, and they range from a discussion of what the department's doing with respect to royalty evaluation and gas liquids to something that has been very public lately, our involvement with ANWR. And any of those things that you would like to discuss, we can discuss also. The Sale 55 that we're talking about today is, for those of you that have it referenced on a map, really, if you look at the large map on the wall, it's the area between the Canadian border where things sort of go to nothingness on the right-hand side, the east side of your map.
Could you point that out, Marlon?
Actually, I can step up there and just from the spot, the Hula River. From this area where Sale 50, the Camden Bay area, Sale ended eastward over to the Canadian border, but it only includes lands that are clearly state-owned submerged lands offshore. As those of you that have followed these issues for a while probably know, there is a dispute that's part of the Beaufort Sea litigation in which we have challenged the federal claim to title for offshore areas in the lagoons off of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And basically, anywhere else that you look along the coast there, typically the state's submerged lands begin at the coastline of the mainland and extend outward for 3 miles, unless there's a barrier island. And at that point, as you all know, the lands extend further 3 miles seaward of that barrier island. And of course, the state owns the barrier islands within 3 miles. Off of ANWR, there's a difference that the federal government claims title to the submerged lands between the barrier islands and the mainland because when the withdrawal was done for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, it specifically withdrew the barrier islands for federal ownership as well. But it's silent about the submerged lands between the barriers and the coastal mainland. So we, the state of Alaska, have claimed title to that, and that's one of the issues that will be decided in the larger Beaufort Sea title litigation. So on the acreage we have title to, where there's no dispute between either the folks on shore in the Fish and Wildlife Service or the folks offshore with the Minerals Management Service, there's about 197,000 acres that we're proposing to offer. And to bring you up to date, this sale was originally put on the state's five-year schedule, in 1984. And it's been one of the few sales that's had almost no change to it since it was originally scheduled. We, I think, shifted it 1 month from its original date. We expected to hold it in May of this year. And we shifted it to June last year when we did the change in the five-year schedule to go from 3 or more sales a year to a scale that is predominantly 2 sales per year. As part of that, we set up our sales so that they would be on December and June just for predictability as well as trying to equalize the workload throughout the year. So this sale did shift to June, and it's on track now with our schedule. We released the preliminary finding for the sale on February the 4th. And the public has until March 8th to submit written comments on that finding. And we're scheduled to produce a final decision and finding on April 25th. And if things continue as we hope, the sale will be held on June 28th of this year. We also are intending to hold a public meeting in Kaktovik. And as yet, we don't have that date scheduled. We've sent a letter to the mayor and requested that they identify the time that would be most convenient to them. And we think it's probably going to be somewhere in the mid-March, maybe the 15th through the 20th. We don't have a confirmed date for that yet. The area is, as I said, has been on the schedule for 4 years. We think it's one of the more important areas to be offered on the schedule as it's now designed. There has been a great deal of interest in this area, and of course, it's like all others. We won't ultimately know what's there until we've had an opportunity for people to take a look and an actual drilling of wells. But this area particularly has generated a lot of interest simply because it is adjacent to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, offshore of the area where the KIC well was drilled. And for those of you that are more current, if you look to the right, again, to the east of Katkovic, I believe it's on this track. This track right here, it's either 890 or I believe it's 890, this track right here, the Aurora well is being drilled right now by Tenneco. And I think there are 11 partners in that well. And of course, it's being drilled on federal acreage just adjacent to our acreage. And we would assume it's being drilled on a prospect, but we also think that it's obvious that part of the impetus for drilling that well now is to get information for our sale area as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to, I guess, how does this all work? When we offer for sale, do we put minimums in the bids?
Yes, we do. Okay. In each sale.
Just reading through this, when I see you're going to issue your final filing on April 25th, but you also say that the confidentiality period for the kick well will expire April 24th, the day before, and you'll have access to that data, and you do have access to the Tenneco data as it's being drilled. Does that knowledge affect what we're going to set the minimum bids and the...
I think it will. We have not decided on sale terms for the sale yet, and we will have a meeting scheduled with the commissioner later before the time for the setting of the final terms.
So you don't have to set those in this final finding then?
We have, in the final notice, when we actually publish the final notice, we have to have decided on the sale terms at that point.
And,
or, of course, face a deferral. We could, under the statutes, defer this sale if there was a reason to defer it for as long as 90 days after the quarter in which it's offered, so until September if there was a need to.
Mr. Chairman, is that April 25th date is the date you have to publish what the sale terms will be?
That's correct.
So the knowledge you get from the kick well on April 24th really is not going to...
That's correct. The kick well will not be available under its projected release date, but we're expecting that we will have a request to extend the confidentiality of that well before that release date.
So it's irrelevant.
No, I don't think it is. Typically, what happens, as you know, AOGCC is the only agency within state government now that has access to that well, since it is on fee land. But the only person who can extend the confidentiality of that well is the Commissioner of Natural Resources, or in this case, myself as their designee. And in order to get that extension, the lessees have to make a showing that this has relevance to the leasing of adjacent open acreage. In order to make that showing, they traditionally have had to make a presentation to us, which includes a description and a review of that data. And I think it would be very risky on their part to not make that request formally and to go through that process before the scheduled expiration date, because they would run the risk of being caught in a situation where we can't review the data and make that decision to extend. So I'm expecting that we will have a request to review that data and make that determination of whether or not to extend the confidentiality before April.
So you'll have that knowledge, and do you use that knowledge then in deciding what sale lease terms will offer this up?
We're certainly going to try to, depending upon the scheduling of when that
you don't have to disclose what it is, but internally you can use it to say
this is
how we should offer.
That's correct. It's just one more piece of information. It could be, it's entirely conceivable that it won't give us a lot of information about what we want to do or a lot of direction we want to do any more than the information we're getting right now from the Tenneco well. The Tenneco well, as a matter of fact, is obviously closer. And probably has, based on what we know from our seismic data, probably has as much relevance or more, given the location, as that kick well.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get a reference here. Most of the charts and maps we saw on the Anwar prospects are to the east of most of that area.
To the west.
To the west of
right.
the area, rather.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So this this is a different type of structure that we're looking at then?
If you remember, there's two large structures that show up on everyone's maps from the 102 report and as well as everything else that we showed you. That's right, the Maguanic High. What this is, in simple terms, is the downflank acreage, off-structure acreage from that very large high that the KIC was drilled on. But it's the data are missing between the location of the KIC well and our acreage in order to draw any clear inferences from seismic. there are seismic data available inside the KIC lands that would tie that well, the KIC well, to the well that is being drilled offshore. But those data, like the well data, are not available to anyone except the people that shot the data. We have seismic data that tie the well location that Tenneco is drilling across the state submerged land. So we have a piece of information that probably no one else has at this point. We're sitting almost analogous to what the folks are over the Kick well, except for the ones in the Tenneco well. And of course, there are a lot of people there, a lot of companies involved. But it's in combination. We probably have some information that some people don't. A lot of people have information, or not a lot of people. Some people in the KIC well have information that very few others do, and it's a combination of things. But that really is about the substance of what I wanted to describe in general terms of what we're doing there. And the decision will be made about early April, to define the sale terms. We're very hopeful that this sale doesn't have the litigation problems that Sale 50 had, but we're preparing, assuming the worst, and hopefully we'll be able to defend any litigation that might be brought on this sale. The status of the other one may be of interest to you also, the Sale 50. As you may recall, we had a real flurry of activity very near the sale date, which ultimately resulted, I think, in our... As I recall, it was on Wednesday before the sale was held the next Tuesday. We ended up in court with a request for an injunction to prevent that sale, and that injunction request was denied, and the sale did continue on schedule, but of course then the litigation followed. And briefs have been filed in that litigation, and it has actually been assigned to a judge, Judge Bosshart, who's going to be the judge. And so far we haven't got a schedule for oral arguments, but we're presuming that will be pretty shortly.
What about that? I got a couple of questions. One of them is, what's the potential variables on the lease, you know, sale conditions? Would you expect to do other than 12.5% royalty, cash bonus bid?
I doubt very seriously that, based on what I know now, that I would recommend anything other than some combination of bonus and royalty to the commissioner. It's ultimately her decision, but I tend, unless there is very clear evidence of something spilling over, if you will, from productive structures nearby, that we have very conclusive or nearly conclusive evidence actually extends into unleased acreage. I tend to, I guess, be more conservative about taking what you can get today versus what you can get tomorrow, maybe with a net profit share. So I tend to recommend those things that, net, for example, net profit share leasing be used more conservatively than perhaps you've seen in the past.
What about royalty variable?
I'm a fan of, and particularly in moderate to high potential areas, I'm a fan of a higher royalty.
Oh, a higher royalty, not a variable.
16 2/3. No, I think the variable royalty is... Again, is something that I would recommend people use pretty carefully, and would recommend it in those situations where you have a real good indication that you're going to have a highly productive structure, something with unusually productive reservoir characteristics that might have wells that are atypically productive, like we now know Prudhoe Bay to be. Those kind of things, obviously, would be nice if you had a variable royalty rate or even a higher base royalty rate or some combination of those two.
Well, what would be the variable then, just the minimums?
The bonus, but again, if this is...
No, I don't mean the variables. I meant what variables might you decide upon as far as stipulations for the sale?
Oh, and in this case, if we were to recommend a 16 2/3% royalty, for example, we still would have the option, and as a matter of fact, we'd have the responsibility for establishing some minimum per acre bid.
Is that what might change depending on what information you receive?
I think it could very well. Yes.
Would there be other things that might change as a result of that?
It's not likely that any of the surface or environmental stipulations would change. I think we've pretty well worked our way through all of those things that I think are pretty close, if not acceptable to everyone now that's involved in the agencies.
I was just trying to follow up on what John was asking there. Once you get that information, the only thing you're likely to change your mind about would be minimums. Is that right? Fair enough. Next question I have is, what if Gaymore doesn't open up? Is it reasonable to expect that development could take place in the state acreage?
We think it is, but, you know, when we say that, we have to qualify it. What happens when you don't have guaranteed access across ANWR for anything from state acreage or federal acreage is it makes the minimum economic discovery larger.
What would be the method of removing oil from offshore acreage if you couldn't come ashore with a pipeline?
Well, you can come ashore on state acreage to the west, and you could do a pipeline
to the west
across the Canning River. You would have to run some sort of pipeline offshore until you can come to a landfall outside of ANWR. Of course, that's much more expensive. No one has done that.
Arctic offshore pipeline. Huh?
That's right.
You'd have to be buried quite a bit.
That's right.
So, therefore, there's a risk that, in fact, it's probably true that if the company makes a bid, they probably discount the value of that bid with one of the unknown factors, and that's right. Whether or not the refuge will be open for development.
That's correct.
So you have probably been questioned on the wisdom of holding the sale until that decision has been made.
We certainly have. That was one of the major elements of the trustees' litigation, was the belief that it was premature. There were a number of things that we considered when we made that decision, and I think they're even more valid today than they were then. But again, I understand that you can have two different perspectives on that. The fact that people were willing to make major investments, again, for those of you that have seen the ANWR presentation, in some cases, some of the acreage that's leased further offshore brought as much as 50 some odd million dollars in bonuses per track. And those tracks are about the size of our tracks.
When were those up for bid?
Those were leased 1987, I believe, or 86. The tracks just north of ANWR. 85, I'm sorry, 1985.
What was the price of
oil in 85? Higher than today, but
again, it was only low 20s.
Yeah, it wasn't extremely high. It certainly wasn't the prices that people were looking at in 79.
Right, it wasn't we were projecting $50
some
in the future
people,
either. So.
Some people were, some people weren't. I mean, at any time, I think some folks are, you always have the bears and the bulls on each end of these projections as well. But another factor that you have out there is a much more costly development than you have on our acreage. You've got water depths which are considerably deeper, and the cost of actually drilling an exploratory well out there and the cost of developing whatever you find out there is going to be a lot higher. So it's a balancing act, but the fact that people are willing to make those kind of investments, and in our view, 3 years ago, the uncertainty had to be even greater than it is today about what might happen in that work. And about what would be available technologically to accommodate it. People are looking
who
real long
the time. Economic benefit here, though? I mean, if you're going to go bid that acreage on one side, I guess you could bid it and say, I'm going to guess ANWR is going to be open, so we'll make a landfall fairly quickly and run an overland pipeline. You bid X, right? But if you think you got to say the downside is that won't happen, how am I going to get this oil out of here? That economic cost is very, very high. Matter of fact, I don't know whether we do a net back to the well. I mean, the pipeline tariff is
sure.
So high there's nothing left for the state.
That's right. We hope not.
Well, if it's bid that way and won that way, then you've built in a large economic cost to get the oil out. If ANWR is then open, your cost factor deteriorates.
Right.
Who gets that cushion?
Well, we hope that cushion is shared. The thing that is clear when you lease something with more uncertainty than you would have if you waited, if you could be assured of having more information tomorrow than you do today, real information, it's clear that you, over time, should make more in the way of bonuses, but it's not clear you'd make more in the way of royalties because you don't have
so you're
certainty.
Saying if you got the overland pipeline, then the cost of moving the oil out is less, the net back is greater, and the state's royalty is worth more.
Well, even more than that, there's the question of whether or not anything is there other than bonus values in the future. And that's the one that we, of course, are hedging on when we make a decision to proceed with a lease sale that is arguably or clearly, depending on the circumstances, likely to get less in bonus value. The quid pro quo has to be that you're hopeful of getting more in expedited bonus or in expedited royalty payments. And there is no assurance of that. That there is assurance that you won't get either if you don't proceed. And that's the sort of dilemma you face when you try to figure out whether to stop and go as you approach a scheduled sell date. And it's not an easy decision, and we don't, you know, again, to use a word you've heard recently, we don't have a crystal ball. It's real difficult sometimes.
It seems maybe safe to say that if there was an assured overland pipeline out of Anwar, you'd get a higher bonus bid.
That's what he's saying.
Yes.
That's why the political stuff comes in here now. If it looks like if you're getting down to June, what date did you use? The 28th?
24th, I believe. Or the 28th, I'm sorry.
By that point, you may be able to, better able to detect the mood of Congress. It seems like you could get right down to a date. What if it looked like here? You're on June 27th, and suddenly you know when the decision is going to be made, and it's going to be made June 29th. Mm-hmm. Do you still hold the sale on 28th at that point?
If it came down to a situation where you had that kind of make or break decision, I think it would be a valid exercise of the option to delay. Sure. And one of the problems we run into, and again, that's something that we find in the statutes, it's good or bad depending on which side you're looking at it from, is that we only have the flexibility to delay a sale once, and we can only delay it for 90 days. Beyond the quarter in which it's scheduled. And in this case, the sale is scheduled for the last week of a quarter, so essentially you've got 92 days of buffer. And if you go beyond that, you would have to put that sale back on the five-year schedule, and it would have to be on the schedule two full calendar years after you put it on before it can be reoffered. And it's sort of that's one of the dilemmas we have, is a decision to delay any sale should never be taken very lightly, because not only do you surely run into this dilemma, so you can only get one more bite at the apple, but if anybody chooses then to litigate procedurally, any delays at that point are essentially unacceptable delays. They're going to put you 2 to 3 years off schedule.
Well, even when you come up with the stipulations of the sale in April, I mean that gives you a couple months more to figure out what's going on, so you could fashion this, you should be able to perhaps fashion that sale based on what's going to happen in the next 2 months, too. I would assume that's going to be plugged into.
We're going to be making some assumptions at that time based on what we think is going to be happening in Anwar, and you know, we're hopeful they'll be the right ones. If things move as quickly as they seem to have moved over the last couple of weeks, it's entirely possible that April will give us a much clearer view of what's going to happen there.
I guess the question I would have is if we get a clear indication that this Congress isn't going to do anything on Anwar, then by June, that it sounds like you're going to either have to make the decision then either to completely stop the sale or delay it 90 days. In other words, and if you stop the sale, that'll be 2 years hence.
That's right. But one of the things we would look at when we made that decision is not only what effect that has on shore and on our land, but what effect that might have on what's going on offshore. Because any decision that people have to develop anything that's discovered there is going to be dependent also on what's happening on the adjacent state lands that might be able to support incremental development costs. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, we're between a rock and a hard place, I guess. We can't just fashion our decision on what happens with Congress here. We have to look at what we might do to other folks as well and how that may affect the economics of our land. In this case, I mean, there are a number of leases out there that the continued exploration and potential development.
Well, they're going to be in the same boat. If onshore, they can't bring it on onshore, then they're either going to have to sit on it or do it on an underwater pipeline.
That's right.
Which needs a lot of volume of oil to support, so you need a lot of increment.
But the thing you should keep in mind here also is that we have a lot of oil sitting at Point Thompson, a lot of condensate and gas. And again, you know, people out here certainly have that in their mind when they, even though it's a long way off, it's clear that anything here can be somewhat smaller to a great deal smaller than could conceivably support itself if it can get to Point Thompson. And the two of them can go, or two or more of them can go further.
What kind of a percentage of condensates can be put in the line? I don't imagine that has to be mixed with oil. Is that correct?
The condensate, the parameters that control what can go in the line now, technically, are more of a pressure consideration than anything else. It depends on the vapor pressure. So the more condensate you put in, the higher the vapor pressure. And the limits are that you can't exceed the specs that perhaps shippers have imposed on oil tendered to that line. And I don't know what those specs are right off the top of my head, I don't know, Mike Katowski is here with me. He doesn't have that number either. But there are limits depending upon the vapor pressure of what you're offering, and I don't know how closely they're pushing those limits now. So I understand there's still a buffer, a pretty good buffer there, but I couldn't give you the exact volumes.
By the way, this map there goes to from the border here over to, you can see that lake in the far corner there, so it covers most of the north coast there, just to give you an idea how that perspective fits in.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that's sort of interesting, I hadn't noticed it before with that map, but for those of you that like to talk about disputes, you'll notice that that map projects the border between Canada and the United States straight offshore. And if you look at the map on the left-hand side, you'll notice that that sort of takes a jog there. And that actually is our interpretation, the United States interpretation of where the boundary goes. It's projected perpendicular to the coastline, and the Canadians claim a straight boundary, and as a matter of fact, they have already leased some of that acreage under exploration agreements years ago, which has since expired. And it's one of those situations that even the Beaufort Sea litigation isn't going to solve for us.
Drill a slant well from our side.
Right. The State Department actually had started negotiating with Canada on that boundary, I think, a couple of years ago. They never really pursued it.
Yeah, we'll wrap that into the Dixon Engine.
That's right.
Down, yeah,
looking at
down in my area down there. Yeah. So.
Well, it makes sense, sort of, you know.
Do other people in the room have questions, Tom? Any,
I was going to ask about federal sales offshore. Could you describe on the federal sales? There's some this spring, I think.
Sale 97, and I don't remember what the date of that sale is, but it has been rescheduled. It's coming up fairly soon.
March 16th.
And that's a reoffering sale of acreage. There have been two major sales out there, sale 83 and 87, as I recall. Or sale 81 and sale 87, I believe it is.
Do you know where the sale 97 acreage is?
There is a, it's a wide swath along, there's a deferral area near Barrow, and otherwise it's essentially acreage along the entire coastline. Mm. Offshore, of course, stuff that's unleased, remaining unleased acreage, and it would extend about over that same area, potentially, that that map on the left does. And there's a deferral just around the Barrow area.
Go ahead, Kurt.
Jim, how long ago was that federal sale where they're drilling the well now? Is that quite a while ago in time?
1985, I believe.
Do you know what the cost per acre on that was?
Well, it was highly variable. A number of these tracts, let me see.
The liquids?
Well, for example, there's a tractor from Chevron and Conoco, partners at $10,233,000 on a bonus. There's a $55,380,000 tract right here, Amoco Shell and Unocal. I think, as a matter of fact, that was probably the highest bid in this area, in the eastern part of the sale area.
Where are they drilling the well now?
The well that is being drilled right now, the Tentacle well, is being drilled on Arco Beach, and I believe it's this one. It's either this one or this one, right adjacent to, I believe it's this one right here, 890.
Is that the only offshore rig in operation right now?
This winter, I believe it is.
And what did they pay for that track?
This one was $437,000. It's a very relatively low bonus value track
for a well.
That was sale 87, and it looks like
that's why I have to do with the field approach right now for a while.
They just have expiration dates for 94 or 10 years, so it must have been 84.
Some of these future sales being in the AG area?
Quite a few of them. Anything that the AG area, for those of you that don't know, is acreage that lies 3 miles seaward of the state's 3 mile boundary. And as you can see, particularly as you go out to the west toward NPRA, excuse me, and around the area of the 1979 sale, around Prudhoe Bay and to the east. Most of that acreage has been leased already, and there's no production from any of that acreage on the federal side, but we are already under the settlement, or under the distribution that was made this year, from the escrow account, we finally have received some money from that. There's quite a bit of money still in escrow for that, and anything that is offered, at least that falls within that 3-mile zone, is considered 8G acreage, and distribution takes place now under a formula that gives the state 27% of those revenues, plus any share, plus its proportionate share of any drained resources from state-owned lands, should there be any, which we hope there won't be.
Has there been any discussion about utilization between federal and state?
There has been, as a matter of fact, there's been some as recently as yesterday in our office. there's a bill that is going to be considered, I think there's a hearing next week or a week after HB 471. That bill is a bill where clearly one or more fields that have been found up there would be able to benefit from that bill. And the one that comes to mind first of all is one that is probably owned by a number of companies, including Shell, Amarillo Hess, Murphy, and Texas Eastern. And that's the area that's generally called Seal Island or North Star. And that area has, that field, although it's not completely delineated yet, it's clear that there are oil reserves underlying both the state and federal acreage. And we were aware of that being a probability as early as about 1984. And we started working back then to try to get a joint state-federal unit agreement. You know, of course, the federal people have a unit agreement form that they use. We have one that we use, and they're not very similar at all. And it took us, as I recall, more than a year of very sometimes nasty meetings to try to work out an agreeable unit form for both parties, as well as the people who were involved in the unit or would be involved. And Shell at that time was was proposed to be the operator of that unit. And we worked with them for well over a year and came to agreement with the feds on a unit form. And just about that time, Shell withdrew their application for a unit and said that they would resubmit it. And to date, they haven't. Those leases are coming up on expirations in 1990, if I recall. And they either, at that point, those that don't have wells on them will expire unless they're committed to a unit. So we're expecting, that's a long way of telling you, I guess, that we're certainly expecting somebody to pay us a visit shortly to talk about unitizing what they've already confirmed is the field limits. Otherwise, there's going to be some risk there that people are going to lose their leases.
Anything else, Mike? Did you have something?
Well, I just had a question about this. We had talked earlier about the controversy and discussion between you versus the oil industry on the value of the gas and what that's costing the companies to get it out. Do you have any kind of figures on what the differences are between what they're saying and what the last is saying?
Yes, we do. The last page of this handout is a breakdown of what people are proposing. For those of you that weren't here last week or haven't had any opportunity to understand what's happening, there are a number of facilities on North Slope now which are processing gas as it comes out of the ground before it gets re-injected. You know, at Prudhoe as elsewhere, you can't flare under state law, so people are re-injecting the gas to keep the reservoir pressure up. And starting just a very few years ago, their folks began to do a little bit more than just re-inject gas. And there are three facilities up there now. There are two in Prudhoe Bay. One's a very large facility that processes a large number of barrels per day. If you look up under NGL settlements, that subheading A, the Prudhoe Bay facility, about 54,048 barrels in December of this past year per day were going through that facility. Also within the Prudhoe Bay unit, there's a small facility that's processing gas just coming from the Lisburn Reservoir, which is deeper beneath the main reservoir at Prudhoe. And that's about 2,260 barrels at that same month. And over in Kaparik, they were at about 3,600 barrels today. And what's happening essentially is the gas is having some of its components chilled, or all the gas is being chilled, some of its heavier components are dropping out. And those heavier gas components, the gas liquids that are in a liquid state once you drop the temperature, are being blended with oil and shipped down the pipeline and sold as crude oil, which is fine. We think that that's, you know, a good approach to utilizing what's there to be utilized, particularly since there's not a market for the gas. It gives us an opportunity as a royalty owner to share in some of that. But it also has some other benefits because they are taking like some of the other gas components like ethane and propane and blending them to help improve the efficiency of the water flow that they have running on. So it's having the advantage not only of putting something in the pipeline to make more royalties for the state, but it's also having an added benefit of making the efficiency of that water flow work better, and that's getting more oil out of the reservoir, and it's also, of course, returning the methane back in the primary constituent of that gas, back into the reservoir, where it'll be available to produce in a gas pipeline someday. But where we don't necessarily agree with what the producers do, and that's, a kind way of saying if I had to really say what I feel, I guess I would say that we have a big disagreement brewing here. But we just haven't been very successful in resolving it yet. And that disagreement is over the value that people claim the state should be sharing in the processing of that gas. And we have a very basic disagreement. These plants are being treated as primarily as gas processing plants rather than as lease facilities, as we think they more properly are, and as we think when we look at the record demonstrates the lessees themselves have treated them over time. The Prudhoe Bay facility is one in which the record establishes that that facility was designed and built to increase or as an enhanced oil recovery facility. As a matter of fact, when the lessees were providing testimony to AOGCC, which was necessary to be certified as an EOR project for federal tax purposes, they made it clear that they felt that the value of that facility would be paid for by the incremental oil value, among other things. And we feel that's properly the way that situation or that facility should be treated, and that the responsibility for that facility and for doing those things is a lease responsibility, which does not entitle the lessees to any payment or any additional payments from the state beyond what we've already agreed to as an oil and gas or as an oil cleaning and hydrating allowance. So we think, for example, at that facility, and we've told the lessees, Standard, Exxon, and ARCO, that we would be agreeable to allowing a 67 cents per barrel deduction, just as we are under the unit agreement settlement for cleaning and hydrating of oil. Instead of 67 cents per barrel, the lessees are each month deducting a different amount, depending upon the lessee, from the royalty values before they pay royalties. And if you look down at the bottom of page 7, you can see what those amounts are. ARCO is deducting $4.39 per barrel. Exxon is deducting, this was in December, $2.54 per barrel. And Standard is deducting $7.34 per barrel. And those of you that can remember last year when oil prices netted back to the wellhead were very low, we actually had some values that were reported as zero values. People were deducting more than the value of the oil. And we, of course, don't agree with that. And we've written letters to all the producers telling them that we don't agree with it and that we want it done as we think it should be done. We've heard from ARCO and Exxon, Standard, although they've had a letter from, I think we issued a letter in September, has yet to reply. And my recommendation is going to be, if Standard's answer is the same as ARCO and Exxon's, but of course we don't know that yet, we're waiting to hear, but if it is, it would be my recommendation then that we litigate this issue, and we're preparing to do that. The facility that, again, within the same unit, the Lismore facility, is deductions on the range of $19 per barrel are being taken there, and that's only order of twice the value of the oil. Kuparik, as you can see, is about $7.79 per barrel.
Well, I'm just curious what that means in terms of overall revenue, the difference between the two, and you know, that's, I assume it's probably a guess at this point, but
well,
we can. I think people have to go, and so I don't want to drag things on.
Did you have something there,
Dan? That's what I was going to ask, Mr. Schumer. Work on those figures.
It's not an easy. I can tell you the immediate difference, the ultimate difference. We won't know until Amarillo has litigation resolved, because we don't really know what the final value of oil, where it's sold, is going to be. It's hard to figure out what in the meantime all this means. But you can figure out the difference between what we are agreeable to deducting, 67 cents per barrel, and what people are deducting. And that per barrel difference times the state royalty share, which is 1/8 of all these barrels, easy number to come to.
Well, you're, I mean, you're, the differences are a long ways off. I mean, between 67 cents and $19 a barrel.
That's correct. Well, in this case, we've got about, it looks like it's about 60,000 barrels per day. And the state share would be 1/8 of that, which is 7,500 approximately. And if you just took an average of the Prudhoe Bay facilities, for example, and that would be, it looks like that value would be somewhere, I'm just guessing now, if anybody has a calculator, you can average those three numbers, somewhere in the order of $5.50 to $6 maybe. Took away this, let's say it's $4.75 would be a nice even number, round number, times 7,500 barrels per day. So that's $300,000 maybe. Is that right?
I wasn't going through that, but that's your amount.
No, I'm sorry, that's right. Yeah. Per week, it's a significant number. Quickly adds up to the budget for the Division of Oil and Gas.
Well, these figures then, are they, now when they bring these figures of $4.39 a barrel, that's just one sheet of paper, right?
No, there's a stack of paper, but it's hard to jump over. But it's...
when they do a rate filing, I thought they have to have, you know, they have to have a backup for the rate filing?
No, this has nothing to do with the rate for the pipeline.
I know that.
Or actually a rate filing of any kind of, you know, formal nature. They just provided each one of them, actually different amounts of paper depending on which lessee you're talking about, but each one of them provided a very detailed breakdown for why and how they calculated what they thought was a legitimate expense. It's two questions, really. There's a legal question that we have a dispute with them, but there are also, in each case, each lessee, there are some different technical disputes that we would have in each lessee's case about what was or was not a proper piece of its expenses, even if we agreed that we had an obligation to pay those.
What you're saying is that should be attributed to the production of gas, that's attributed to the overall production of the oil.
We're saying that their treatment of that gas right now would be necessary regardless of what was happening up there over time. And that...
We can pursue this further if you'd like.
We'd be happy to spend as much time at another forum if you like, as you need. Because it is a very complex issue, and we took about, we're well over a year and a half now reviewing the detailed submittals that people have made and just coming to the point that we're able to give them the notice of what we want and what we think is proper. So it's not an easy thing to understand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Anything else?
I'd just like to hear a follow-up if we set up another appointment or something on that issue, Sam.
I would too. I'm a little fuzzy on it. Muzzy, I think, is the word.
Yeah, something. Thank you.
For sure.